there was an organization called Shalom Task Force that was founded. And this is an organization and hotline that caters to the Jewish community as a resource for those who might find themselves in situations of domestic violence, sexual assault, and the like. I think that it's very telling that the Jewish community, the Orthodox community, responded much faster than many other segments of society did to this issue as it was brought to their attention.
Welcome to Ending Domestic Abuse, a one-of-a-kind virtual resource for helping victims escape abuse, empowering survivors, and preventing relationship violence before it can even start by giving you the tools to improve your confidence, life skills, and hope. I'm your host, Dr. Ludy Green, a national expert on violence against women and children. I have advocated across the world and directly helped more than 1,000 abused women regain and maintain their freedom through economic independence. Today's episode will be a new series focusing on discussions of violence against women from faith-based communities' perspective. We will be featuring Esti Hecht, co-founder and director of Chabad at American University. We're so excited to have her on today to share advice, her expertise, and act as your virtual mentor. We will be right back after this short break. Ending Domestic Abuse is brought to you by Audible. Something you need to know about me is that I love to multitask. As an entrepreneur who had to build her own path to success, I'm always looking for ways to continue learning and to use my time more effectively. Audible has been a great resource for me. I can have access to hundreds of audiobooks from the palm of my hand and listen to them as I commute to work, while cook dinner, and when I go on a run. Listeners who enjoy our last episode about self-care will love Audible's huge list of self-help books, as well as their guided wellness program. It is so important to continue to learn and improve yourself. You are worth it. Don't wait. Head to audibletrial.com/endingdomesticabuse to start your free trial so they know we sent you. All proceeds will go to improving this podcast to help even more victims of violence. Once again, audibletrial.com/endingdomesticabuse. Welcome back to Ending Domestic Abuse, and this is your host, Dr. Ludy Green. We're excited to be starting a new series of episodes on ending domestic abuse that will focus on discussions of violence against women from faith-based perspectives. These conversations are to educate and increase understanding of how different faith-based communities approach the issue of violence against women. Today will be our first episode where we will be discussing violence against women, relationships, and women's empowerment within the context of Orthodox Jewish communities. In popular culture recently, there has been an increasing in portrayals of Orthodox Jewish culture and religion through Netflix shows such as One of Us, Unorthodox, and the reality show My Unorthodox Lives. These shows have sparked a lot of conversations surrounding these communities from people both within and outside of the Jewish community. This popularity has put a spotlight on some communities. However, many of the viewers of these shows may have little to no background knowledge or understanding of the Jewish communities and Judaism. So today we want to take time to learn more about one Orthodox community in the United States, Chabad. Esti Hecht, Director of Chabad at American University in Washington, D.C., is here with us today to share her knowledge and expertise as an international educator and a speaker. She's a leader within her community, and we are honored to have her with us today, as it is so vital to have open and honest conversations about these topics to ensure people are well-informed and educated. Esti, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you so much, Ludy, for having me. I'm very excited to finally making this happen.
To start off, could you please tell our listeners a bit more about yourself, your background, and your career?
Sure. So my name is Esti Hecht, and I was born actually in Sydney, Australia. I grew up and have lived more or less consistently here, right here in Washington, D.C. over the last 3 decades. I was raised in a Chabad Hasidic family. That was my upbringing. And I'm incredibly passionate about Jewish education as it relates to everyone from young children to grown adults, specifically Torah's insight into the areas of healthy relationships and development. I've been supremely lucky to have had opportunities from a very young age to pursue this passion, first in volunteer capacities and then in leadership roles. And I've had the opportunity to work in and with organizations from across the country, to speak internationally, to teach, consult, and to help shape Jewish educational opportunities for everyone. Like I like to say, for everyone from babies to bubbies. Bubbies is grandmother in Yiddish. My degrees and certifications are also in the field of Jewish education. And together with my husband, I co-founded Chabad at American University. And I also direct a boutique Jewish learning program called Hebrew School to You.
Listen, so you co-founded Chabad at American University. Can you tell us a bit more about the organization and what initiatives and programming you all do? For listeners who don't know much about the Jewish community, could you also share a bit more about the history of Chabad and its presence in the United States and how your family were influencers of it?
Sure. So I'll answer your second question first. So Chabad is a sect of Hasidic Jews, with the word Chabad referring to a philosophy and approach to traditionally observed religious Judaism, what people tend to refer to as Orthodox Judaism. There are a couple of things that make Chabad Hasidus or Chabad Hasidism slightly different than other Hasidic sects. For one, it emphasizes an intellectual approach to observance rather than a purely emotional or dogmatic one. Chabad is actually an acronym for three Hebrew words, Chachma, Bina, and Da'as, that loosely translate as knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. Many Hasidic groups, in contrast to Chabad, many Hasidic groups aim to create as insular a community as possible, to keep out secular influences in an effort to retain and protect their traditions. But Chabad takes the exact opposite approach. So through the Chabad lens, everything in the world is seen as an opportunity for goodness, as an opportunity for holiness, as an opportunity for godliness. As an example, not a lot of people know this, but the website Chabad.org, which is where you can find tons of information about Chabad, the philosophy, and Chabad, the organization, was registered in 1993, before YouTube, before Google, before Yahoo. And even that was sort of an updated version of something that had existed as a pre-internet forum for conversation about topics. So as soon as there's a new technology, there's someone in Chabad finding a way to use it for good. Now, Judaism in general does not believe in proselytizing or pushing conversion. We believe that people who aren't Jewish can lead very meaningful lives serving God through other faiths. At the same time, we do believe that every person who is Jewish should have access to Judaism should they want to. And as such, a core tenet of Chabad philosophy is making Jewish practice and Jewish learning accessible. And that tenet births an organization by the same name, Chabad Lubavitch, in which there are thousands of family-run, independently funded branches around the world. These are called Chabad houses, even though sometimes they might have thousands of attendees, they might be in commercial spaces, they still go by the name Chabad house, and they effectively serve as Jewish embassies around the world. So first Chabad houses in the US was founded by my grandparents in Pennsylvania just about 60 years ago. My husband's grandparents did similar in Morocco and Tunisia. My maternal grandparents did similar in Australia. And until today, I have my family working in Cape Town, in Uruguay, in Hong Kong, and wherever they are, Chabad provides tailored support to their community. So sometimes it's humanitarian needs, sometimes it's emotional help, sometimes it's religious study opportunities. So at Chabad AU specifically, we work hard to meet the needs of the community at American, as well as the surrounding neighborhood. And we do that by providing Shabbat and holiday meals for students, crisis intervention as necessary, Torah study opportunities, youth education opportunities, volunteer opportunities, hospital visitations, whatever is needed and we are able to provide, we do.
What an amazing community. And I have seen it myself. I was invited, my husband, both of us were invited. We have seen your work and it's unbelievable. We both highly respect you both.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you over.
Listen, we're very grateful to have you on the show today and to have an open conversation about relationships and marriage. Can you speak a bit about marriage within your community and how did you meet your husband and what was the dating process like?
Sure. So anyone who knows me knows that this is one of my favorite topics and one of my favorite stories to tell. I mean, if you ask my husband how we met, he'll say, someone set us up. But that's a very short version, which is a reflection of the fact that he likes to speak very concisely. But before I share that story, I'll sort of dispel a very common myth about our community. And that is that according to Jewish law, couples actually do have to consent to marriage. And for those listeners who are at all familiar with biblical stories, they'll know that this is not some modern shift in religious thinking. This tradition actually goes back more than 3,000 years to to the biblical Rebecca, whose father turned to her to ask for her consent to a marriage proposal to Isaac. So this is way before this was even a conversation in broader society. So with that in mind, how does that play out practically? So dating in the religious world is slightly different than the dating of Hinge and Tinder and hookup culture. And I'll start with a disclaimer of saying that every community has those that follow its norms and those that follow their own path. And it would be untrue to say that every single young person follows the following prescribed method. But I would say that a very strong majority do, and it tends to work very well. So I'll use my experience as a very good example. So we use what we refer to as the shidduch system. Shidduch is the Hebrew word for match, specifically a match between two people. And so as a teenager, school, pimps, all of my social experiences were all gender specific. You know, the girls were with girls, the boys were with boys. And of course, I had some friends who would hang out with guys, but that wasn't the norm. And certainly casual dating or everything that is encompassed by that term or that term is used as a euphemism for was definitely not encouraged or common. And interestingly, throughout these years, we often had many conversations, both formal and informal, in school or with friends, about healthy relationships and how to achieve what Judaism calls shalom bayis, peace in the home. And this is definitely a recurring theme throughout high school and post-high school years, with many schools offering classes entitled Jewish Home, Jewish Marriage, or similar, even starting in the younger high school years. So that's sort of the perspective we're raised with. We're raised with lots of opportunities to think about and discuss what kind of person we want to marry and what kind of person we want to be within a marriage. And so when a young person feels that they are ready for marriage, typically around 19 or 20 years old for girls or around 22, 23 for boys in my community, and that age shifts based on communal norms within each of the different religious communities, they will have a conversation like I did with my parents about what you're looking for in a partner. Everything from the superficial, like what looks you're looking for, what kind of family you're looking for, to the significant, like what values are important, what you expect your role and your partner's role to be in marriage. And then it becomes, interestingly, the job of the parent to try and find relevant matches that make sense for their child. So they sort of serve as a human algorithm. And the singles, what I did was you typically create a resume, except instead of it having your work experience, it has a list of different references that people could call to find out about you. And because we're a pretty interconnected community, the resume will list friends or former teachers, places you've worked. It's not uncommon for a prospective match to find a mutual acquaintance on that resume and be able to call someone who might know both of you. And so parents will do the hard and sometimes very long work of researching the different candidates. And if they find one that they think fits the bill, they'll present it to their son or daughter. So to the point,
I love it. I love it. I think it's fun. It's nice.
To the point of your question about, you know, whether we have a say in who we marry or something like that, the very first question my father asked me when we were having this conversation, when I said, you know, I think I'm ready to get married, was, you know, Essie, do you have anyone specific in mind? Like, do you have a friend whose brother you're interested in? Have you ever sat at a Shabbos meal with somebody that you'd like us to look into? And I think he might have been a little disappointed when I said no, because that meant that he actually had to do the work. No, I'm kidding. I mean, for me and for each of my siblings, my parents have done a great job at fulfilling their responsibility. But it is very normal within our community that people will make what are called shidduch suggestions, right? Like I might set up my friend with my cousin or something like that. Some people are helpful. Some people are nosy. Most people are somewhere in the middle. So I was very thankful that lots of people made suggestions, but nothing really felt like a good fit. And of relatively minimal importance, I had always wanted to marry someone unusually tall. And that is not the thing that is common if you have Ashkenazi Jewish genetics. So, and it just so happened that each prospective suggestion was not only not tall, but was shorter than me. Now, I didn't say no. That, but it was sort of like they're nickeling in the back of my mind. Like, this is really ironic. This is the opposite extreme. And so one day I was in Crown Heights, which is the Chabad community in Brooklyn. And I was walking down the street gossiping with my friend, and we were talking about the shidduch system. And I was saying how it just seemed to me like the whole community was short. Now, your listeners, kids, but I give a somewhat taller impression than I am, but I'm a very average height of 5'5". So to find someone taller than me did not seem to be like the craziest thing in the world. And my friend points across the street at this very tall young man who's on the phone and says, well, that guy's not short. And I replied, well, we don't know who that guy is. And besides, that's not how it works. You don't just walk down the street and say, oh, I'll take that one, right? So turns out we continue this conversation and she's like, oh, actually, I'm pretty sure I do know who that guy is because I met his aunt at an engagement party last week. And the aunt had apparently been asking her, she saw this young woman. She's like, oh, do you happen to have any suggestions for my nephew? He's looking to get married. And of course, my friend being, you know, a typical young person, promptly went online to check out his social media profile to see exactly who this elderly aunt was talking about. Like I said, that perfect mix of nosy and helpful. And so we continued walking right past and chatting with her discreetly pointing out other people that we passed. But I remember going home and mentioning this tall person to my mother. Anyway, unrelated, a week later, my mother's friend, who's a matchmaker, texts my mother out of the blue, asking if I would consider somebody who's from a Chabad family, but French, even though there might be a culture difference. And when my mother asked me this, I thought, hey, that guy we passed last week was also French, at least according to my friend. What are the odds? Wow. I wonder if it's the same guy. And so I didn't know much about him. So I asked if he was tall. And my mother's friend responded immediately, I don't know how tall, but very tall. Like, that's not going to be an issue. And I'm thinking, Chabad family, French, tall guy, speaks enough English to be set up with an American, but we had never even interacted. The odds of this were really low. So I asked what his name is and at the same time messaged my friend, what was the name of that person we passed? And it turned out it was the same person. And so considering that I knew nothing about him, aside from him being tall and French, I asked my mother to look into him and she did and heard great things. And we said yes, and he said yes. And we went out a week later. Now, would you like me to explain sort of what that process is like, the dating process? Because I think people tend to have a lot of questions about that as well.
Or even briefly, sure. So people can understand.
So the number one question I get asked is like, do you have a chaperone, right? Do your parents come along with you on dates? So what happens is that it's both the young man and woman are interested, a matchmaker makes the connection, and the two go out on a date. So in observance of Jewish law, men and women who are not immediately related to each other and are not married to each other do not touch at all. So the dates involve talking, and given my personality, as you can probably tell, even through the microphone, let's just say a lot of talking. Jewish law also requires that a man and woman who are not related to each other, married to each other, to not be alone in a private space. So dates take place somewhere that there will be people around. So in our case, getting a soft drink in a hotel lobby, walking around the city, whether it was Manhattan or DC, dates that are conducive for conversation. So we're not being chaperoned, but we're also meeting in a space that is actually conducive for getting to know each other. And I think that one huge difference between the shidduch system and secular dating is that from date one, marriage is on the table. So if you're not interested in marriage, you're not going out with this person in the first place. So it's not weird to have a conversation from your second or third date about parenting styles, what kind of home you want to have. And, you know, very briefly, you get back to the matchmaker, he gets back to the matchmaker. If you both say yes, you go out again. If one side says no, the matchmaker might try to convince you to say yes. But if it's something that just doesn't work, you just say no. And that eliminates the whole, where are we holding? What are we conversation? Some people choose to keep the matchmaker until the end of the dating process. Some people drop the matchmaker after a few dates. And it's normal to ask advice from parents or family or friends or whatever, or even sometimes a paid dating coach. But ultimately, you're the one who has to decide. And so for this reason, people typically keep their dating life relatively private so that they can make their decision without the input of everybody and their neighbor and be able to just get advice from those who they value. And so as for my husband and I, we just celebrated our 12th anniversary this past summer. So I'm very grateful.
Congratulations. What a beautiful way. I mean, it's like the time of the romanticism, you know, thinking about if you think about that, the Gilded Age or times before, you know, where people just weren't decorating on each other, but they couldn't touch. And so it feels safe and beautiful, to be honest. It feels very, very beautiful. So congratulations on your 12-year marriage.
Thank you.
Listen, a lot of TV shows and movies have come out in recent years that show some sects of Orthodox Judaism as very restrictive of the rights of women. Can you speak a bit about women's roles in Chabad, and if you have any insight on these depictions of Jewish women in media?
Sure. So I think we all know intellectually that what we watch on Netflix or Hulu or, you know, whenever it's the latest streaming system, there's a new one every week, is made for TV. And we know in our minds that the drama is what keeps us streaming a series and that a boring show is not going to get picked up for a second season. However, somehow when we watch a show about, and I know I'm guilty of this for sure as well, when we watch a show about a community that isn't our own, we tend to forget this fact and we come to believe that that which is presented by Hollywood is indeed a factual representation. And in society at large, for example, there are many healthy families, there are many healthy marriages, people making an honest living, great parents with balanced, well-raised children, but you wouldn't know it by scrolling through our popular media platforms because normalcy and functionality and people who are happy with their lives does not make good TV. So the same is true for religious communities. I know this to be true of mine as a fact, and I imagine that it's probably true for so many other communities that are portrayed negatively in TV shows and other forms of media. Because every community is made of human beings, and because to be human is to be imperfect, there will in every community, of course, every community made of humans at least, be those who struggle with alcoholism, with infidelity, with domestic violence. But that is the exception, not the rule. And you, Ludi, you know from your work that unfortunately these issues and those of the mental health challenges that often underlie these issues tend to be statistically consistent across communities of all faiths, of all races, of all ethnicities. The majority of people in any society tend to be good, healthy people leading good, healthy lives. So to say that the stories presented in these shows couldn't have happened or never happened would be untrue. But to imply that these are the experiences of the majority or even a significant minority of the community that I come from is simply a gross misrepresentation. And so one of the pieces that I love about my work and personally my life experience is the opportunity to shatter these stereotypes. I think it's human nature to be wary of people that are different than us, especially when those differences come across so obviously in dress or language. I mean, see me walking down the street with my husband or my children, it's very clear that we are religious Jews. But bridges are not built through broad strokes painted in the above-mentioned shows. They're built through real conversations that take place with real people, like conversations that you and I had. And so I'd very much encourage the listeners to take that approach with my community and with other communities that might be foreign to them. You know, the next time you're seated on a plane and there's a religious person sitting next to you, start a conversation. Rather than judging them for who you think they are, give them the opportunity to share their own narrative, just like you would want someone else to do for you. And spend some time in the communities that interest you. Don't just observe them from afar, articles that are written with an agenda in mind. I know that, you know, you want to get to know people like me, reach out to your local Chabad if you want opportunities to develop a personal connection. That's on a personal level. On a professional level, Chabad houses, even as far back as, like I said, when my grandparents started over 60 years ago, have been co-directed from the beginning by husband-wife teams. So in traditional Judaism, for reasons beyond the purview of this podcast, only men serve in the rabbinate. However, women serve as leaders in many other capacities, directing educational institutions, offering religious guidance, and serving as equal respected partners. And so in Chabad, female leadership was normalized way before that was the case in so many other segments of secular society. But uniquely, the female leadership is exactly that, leadership that allows women to lead without compromising their femininity, without compromising their dedication to family, without compromising on modesty as a core value. And while that's a hard balance to maintain, I think Chabad does it very well. On the last level I want to share with you is with regard to practice. And I think that your listeners will find this very interesting. Jewish tradition expects that women are respected. And so every Friday night at the Sabbath meal that serves as the gathering space of family and friends, there's a song that is sung, a poem written by King Solomon, every week in every home to celebrate and honor the Jewish woman. Jewish tradition teaches us that each exile from which Jewish people were redeemed was in merit of the women. And that bina yisirad nitna leisha, a greater dose of wisdom was given to women. So in some areas, men are seen as having greater strength. In others, women. Torah is clear that every person has their unique contribution to make, men and women. And while as human beings, we aren't always perfect, to live with Torah values, to live with Jewish values, especially as deepened through Hasidic philosophy, is to live with respect and kindness to all others.
Very interesting. Listen, our podcast, as you know, focuses on violence against women, which can take many forms, including domestic violence, human trafficking, sexual assault, and can happen to anyone from any background, like you just said a minute ago, and that's how it is. How does this type of violence impact your community, if you have any, you know, information, and how can people find support if they are experiencing violence?
Sure, and I think this is a really important question. I know your podcast touches on this topic in so many different ways and manages to reflect a very broad continuum of society in the views that are shared. So I'm going to stick to what I feel I can add to the conversation. Like you mentioned, we discussed a little bit earlier, that domestic abuse exists in every community is an unfortunate reality, one that I know you have spent your lifetime, you know, working to rectify. And I think that we are judged not by what exists around us, but how we respond. So I think, you know, the work that you do is in this regard is incredibly commendable because this uh, these challenges exist. The question is, what do we do about it? So interestingly, you know, you're very familiar with the Violence Against Women Act, right? Which is a landmark act that was passed by the U.S. Congress. 2 years before that was passed, there was an organization called Shalom Task Force that was founded. And this is an organization and hotline that caters to the Jewish community as a resource for those who might find themselves in situations of domestic violence, sexual assault, and the like. I think that it's very telling that the Jewish community, the Orthodox community, responded much faster than many other segments of society did to this issue as it was brought to their attention. I know that growing up, almost every institution that I've attended, from school to camp to synagogues, had signs for Shalom Task Force and JCADA, the Jewish Coalition Against Domestic Violence, in their restroom, with information accessible to anyone. And so while it's addressed discreetly, I was aware of these organizations as young as middle school. And my high school even had, I think when we were maybe in 10th grade or 11th grade, they had Shalom Task Force come do a prevention workshop for us about red flags to look out to when dating. So I think in terms of addressing these conversations, I would say the community is you know, definitely involved, if not at the forefront. I've also found it fascinating how Jewish law approaches these issues, in large part by putting so many preventative measures in place. One challenge that victims or survivors tend to face is convincing people that what happened to them was indeed wrong and not just their perception of something that took place. And Jewish law is very clear. Any touch between non-married, non-related man and woman is not allowed. Being alone in a secluded space is not allowed. Exposure of certain areas of the body in those who are not related and not married is not allowed. So this means that an unwanted tap on the shoulder is already crossing an objective line. Your boss asking you to stay late when no one else is around is already crossing an objective line. And even within a marriage, preceding the Me Too movement by about 2,500 years, Jewish law requires consent in physical connection between a husband and wife, even between a husband and wife. And so
that's unbelievable.
Yeah, which is, I think, incredible, you know, when we talk about consent, when we talk about things of that nature, how the society is sort of just catching up to what my community has been taught for thousands of years. And so, of course, these guidelines cannot prevent willful violence, but they can help us arm ourselves with clarity and can help us maintain sensitivity to our part of our lives that has the power to be so connective rather than destructive. So Jewish tradition has many teachings about encouraging husband and wife to focus on each other to the exclusion of others, to build a strong foundation. We have the practice of mikvah as well that helps maintain a flourishing marriage. And our culture, our perspective, our philosophy emphasizes marriage, emphasizes this community, family. And all of these lay the groundwork for healthy, wholesome relationships and help an individual understand for themselves where their lines are and what is and isn't okay.
This is unbelievable. I mean, I am grateful for the amount of information you have given to us, to our listeners. I'm learning even new things that I have not known before. You are an incredible educator, honestly. And
thank you.
I mean, thank you so much.
I'm trying to condense as much as I can.
this is perfect.
Nice answer.
Yeah. You know, because some people, they only right now 15 to 20 minutes. That's what they say. Yes. I want to thank you so, so much for sharing your knowledge with us today. And how can our listeners keep up with Chabad at AU, at American University, and other initiatives you're involved in that people can be interested in being part of it?
Sure. So first of all, thank you so much for having me. Listeners are welcome to reach out to me directly via our Instagram handle at Chabad AU. And that's also where local listeners can find out some information about different programs that we are hosting here. And if anyone wants to reach out to me directly, they can get my email through you. As you and I have discussed, I'm in the process of launching a website and podcast, which should be available soon at sehef.com. So those who might be listening to this, to the recording of this podcast in a few months' time, should be able to find more information there as well. But we didn't want to put up doing the podcast and sitting down together. So, you know, we'll have to come back and do another one once that's long.
Thanks once again to our guest, Esti Hecht, co-founder of Chabad at American University. And thanks to you for listening. No matter who you are or what you have been through, you can find help and you can find a way out of abuse and into your new life. Send us an email through our website at ludigreen.com. That's ludigreen.com. Or you can call our abuse hotline at 202-643-2327. That's 202-643-2327. We'll help you find a way out to freedom. You can find me on social media at Dr. Ludigreen on Instagram and Twitter. You can also help stop abuse by spreading word of our podcast. Just go on Spotify and please give us a 5-star rating or share your comments. Thank you again. And together, let's all find the life you deserve.